I want you to just picture the phrase flower power in your mind, like right now.
Yeah, and I am willing to bet a very specific, almost cliche image instantly pops up for
Oh,
you.
absolutely. You're probably picturing, the classic 1960s hippie counterculture.
Right, the tie-dye shirts.
Yeah. Tie-dye, kids sitting in a muddy field listening to psychedelic rock, peace signs everywhere.
And those brightly painted Volkswagen vans, of course.
Obviously. It feels like a fashion statement, right? Like the soft, most passive lifestyle brand from this bygone era.
It really does. I mean, over the decades, it has completely become shorthand for a very specific kind of nostalgia. When we think of it today, it just feels, well, entirely harmless.
Harmless is the exact word. But the source material we are diving into today completely shatters that perception.
Totally shatters it.
Because that soft, fashion-forward nostalgia, that is a total myth. At least, in terms of how it all actually began.
Right, the truth is, flower power did not start as a cool aesthetic.
No, not at all. It began as a highly calculated, desperate, tactical maneuver for sheer physical survival.
It was a literal defense mechanism against a very real, imminent threat of extreme violence.
And that transformation is exactly what we're going to explore today. So, welcome to our deep dive into an excerpted historical overview. It's titled Flower Power Movement: History, Fashion, and Music of the 1960s by Megan Pease.
And the goal for this conversation is to trace the hidden, honestly fascinating evolution of this movement.
Yeah, we're going to follow it from its gritty origins as a street-level de-escalation tactic in Berkeley and then watch how it morphed.
Morphed into this nationwide political weapon, right?
Exactly. And finally, we'll decode how it exploded into the mainstream pop culture aesthetic we recognize today.
But to do that, we really have to strip away the nostalgia and look at the raw historical context.
Set the stage for us a bit.
Sure. So picture the United States in the mid-1960s. This was an era defined by incredibly intense, volatile division over the Vietnam War.
And just to be clear, our focus today isn't to take a side or relitigate the politics of that conflict.
Right, not at all. Instead, we are looking strictly at the mechanics of human behavior.
Yeah, we want to understand how the people living through that specific moment utilized symbols, specifically a fragile flower.
Exactly. How they used it to navigate and manipulate a deeply explosive social environment.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Take us back to the spark, the exact moment this phrase was actually coined.
Because the origin story is wild.
It really is. It starts with a deeply localized, terrifying problem in California, right?
Yeah, so we are in Berkeley, California in November 1965.
Yeah.
And protesters who are actively demonstrating against the Vietnam War are facing this massive logistical and physical nightmare.
Because they aren't just worried about clashes with the police
Right.
or like pushback from politicians.
No, it's much worse. They're being actively publicly threatened by the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang.
Which is just a terrifying prospect.
Absolutely terrifying. The Hell's Angels at that time were publicly supporting the war effort, and they equated the anti-war protesters with communists.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they had made it very clear that they intended to physically intercept and violently disrupt the planned anti-war marches at the University of California, Berkeley.
So if you're a protester, you are facing the very real specter of organized biker violence.
A massive street brawl is basically looming.
And this is where the American beat poet Allen Ginsberg steps in.
Right.
He looks at this impending bloodbath and he writes an essay titled How to Make a March Spectacle.
And his grand solution to an incoming wave of motorcycle gang violence is to hand out flowers.
It sounds so absurd at first. He tells the protesters to bring masses of flowers, toys, flags, and candy.
And to hand them directly to the policemen, the press, and the spectators.
He wanted to turn these rallies into what he called street theater.
Exactly. The goal wasn't just to look nice. The goal was to actively engineer a reduction in fear and anger.
What's fascinating here is Ginsberg was trying to fundamentally change the emotional temperature of the space.
He really was.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the mechanics of this, though, because from a modern perspective, this sounds like brilliant, high-level crisis management or PR.
Oh, for sure.
Like, if you have two angry groups screaming at each other on a street corner, the visual narrative is totally set. It's a brawl.
And a group like the Hell's Angels. They thrive in a brawl. They know the rules of a street fight.
Exactly. But Ginsberg is changing the rules of engagement, isn't he?
He is completely rewriting the script of human conflict. The core mechanism at play here is cognitive dissonance.
Right.
Which is a psychological term that basically means the mental discomfort you feel when your beliefs contradict reality. Or, you know, when a situation completely defies your expectations.
It was like a brain short circuit.
Essentially, yes.
Imagine you're aggressively approaching someone, fully braced for them to throw a punch or yell back, and instead they smile and hand you a daisy and a piece of candy.
Your brain literally doesn't have a pre-programmed response for that. Handing someone a flower disrupts the standard dynamics of physical aggression.
Because when an aggressor approaches looking for a fight, they require defensive posturing or counter-aggression to justify their violence.
Precisely. By offering a flower, the protester takes a position of physical vulnerability and transforms it into a position of affirmative, peaceful strength.
It disarms the aggressor not with force, but with total confusion.
You simply can't execute a conventional violent street fight if the other side is blowing bubbles at you. It strips the aggressors of their power to provoke.
And according to the source, this tactic worked beautifully in Berkeley. The protest happened, the violence was largely mitigated, and flower power was born as this defensive shield.
But a shield is only good for defense.
Right. As we move into 1966 and 1967, this tactic starts moving east, and protesters start trying to use this defensive shield as an offensive sword.
Yeah, it evolves from a local de-escalation tactic into a broader strategy of deliberate confrontation.
Which is the birth of what they called guerrilla theater.
Let's define there for a second, because guerrilla theater sounds like an oxymoron.
It really does.
Guerrilla theater refers to surprise performances in public spaces, usually designed to shock the public or draw attention to a political issue.
So it's taking the protest out of the designated march and putting it directly in the face of unsuspecting people?
Exactly. Like in New York City, groups like the Bread and Puppet Theater started handing out balloons and flowers alongside their anti-war literature.
And a magazine called One Workshop in Nonviolence started heavily promoting the tactic.
Which brings us to a major turning point in May 1967.
Yes, an activist named Abby Hoffman organizes the Flower Brigade.
And they decided to take this guerrilla theater and crash an official New York City parade that was honoring soldiers fighting in Vietnam.
They show up carrying flowers, flags, and pink posters with the word love on them.
But the reception they get on the East Coast is vastly different from Berkeley.
It went badly, right?
Very badly. Bystanders actually attacked and physically beat the members of the Flower Brigade.
That is a brutal reality check. It proved that simply holding a flower doesn't grant you some magical force field against an angry mob.
No, it doesn't. But what is truly fascinating is Hoffman's reaction.
He didn't abandon the tactic after getting beaten up.
Not at all. He doubled down.
He writes this incredibly defiant response in W Magazine. Let me quote this because the language is really striking.
Go for it.
He says, "Plans are being made to mine the East River with daffodils. Dandelion chains are being wrapped around induction centers. The cry of flower power echoes through the land. We shall not wilt."
Notice what he's doing there. He is taking the delicate imagery of Florida daffodils, dandelions, and applying the aggressive, destructive vocabulary of military tactics.
Mining a river, wrapping chains around a building.
He is conceptually weaponizing the flower.
But okay, I have to push back right here because logically this makes no sense to me.
Oh, see.
Well, Hoffman gets his people beaten up in May. His immediate follow-up, a Flower Power Day rally in Central Park, is a total dud with terrible turnout.
True.
And his takeaway from all this failure is that the movement needs to be more confrontational.
That's the paradox.
So in October 1967, he and Jerry Rubin organized the massive march on the Pentagon. But how can holding a flower be confrontational against the literal U.S. military?
It sounds absurd.
If bystanders in New York were willing to beat them up, what do they think armed soldiers are going to do? It sounds suicidal.
This raises an important question. If you are thinking at it purely in terms of physical confrontation, you're right, it would be suicidal.
Exactly.
But Hoffman had realized something crucial. The real battleground wasn't the physical space in front of the Pentagon.
Oh, I see.
The battleground was the camera lens. He was staging an optical confrontation, not a physical one.
An optical confrontation. Okay, explain how that works in practice.
Think about the most iconic photograph to come out of that march on the Pentagon. It was taken by a French photojournalist named Marc Riboud.
I know the exact image you are talking
Like
about.
people do, yeah.
It's of a young 17-year-old high school student named Yann Rose Casimir.
Brit.
She has short hair, she's clasping a single daisy, and she is holding it up directly in front of her face.
And she is standing inches away from a line of military police.
Who are holding rifles with fixed bayonets.
Yeah. The Smithsonian Magazine later described that photograph as a gauzy juxtaposition of armed force and flower child innocence.
A gauzy juxtaposition.
And that juxtaposition is the entire point. That is the confrontation.
Hawkman understood that you cannot physically fight the military.
Exactly. But you can force the media, and by extension the millions of people watching at home, to witness a visual disparity that is utterly impossible to ignore.
I see. So it's about forcing the viewer to make a judgment. You place the ultimate symbol of fragile innocence, a teenage girl with a weed, against the ultimate symbol of lethal state power.
Cold steel bayonets.
Right.
When you see that image on your television or in a newspaper, your brain naturally asks, who is the real threat here?
Why does the greatest military force on Earth need fixed bayonets to deal with a teenager holding a daisy?
The confrontation doesn't happen on the lawn of the Pentagon. It happens inside the mind of the American public.
They weaponized innocence to make the opposition look absurd or even monstrous.
That is brilliant. They really turned the camera into their greatest asset.
But, you know, while the East Coast is busy using the flower for these high-stakes optical confrontations, the West Coast is undergoing a totally different evolution.
Yeah, a much more cultural one.
If New York was the political battleground, San Francisco was becoming the cultural ecosystem.
Specifically, the Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco.
Right.
By the mid-1960s, that single intersection had become the undisputed epicenter, basically the gravitational core for this new way of living.
And what fascinates me is the mechanism of how this community grew, because it wasn't just political pamphlets drawing people in.
No, it was a soundtrack.
Haight-Ashbury became the focal point for psychedelic rock music. You had legendary musicians like Jefferson Airplane, The Grateful Dead, and Janis Joplin.
All living within a few blocks of each other.
Exactly.
The music was essential because it structurally embodied the movement. Psychedelic rock wasn't just traditional pop music with different lyrics.
It actively rejected the rigid standard formulas of music from the 1950s.
It was fluid, it was improvisational, it broke boundaries, just like the youth in Haight-Ashbury were trying to break the rigid social and military boundaries of the era.
And this creative energy absolutely explodes during the 1967 Summer of Love.
Oh, completely.
The source points out that thousands upon thousands of young people flooded into the neighborhood. And a massive catalyst for this migration was a single hit song.
San Francisco, be sure to wear flowers in your hair.
Yes. It functioned as a literal set of instructions.
It really did.
It was a siren song broadcast across the radio waves, inviting people to join the community.
But it wasn't just the music bringing people in. You were the mainstream media.
Right, which is huge.
Imagine you are part of a very niche, underground subculture, and suddenly the biggest news outlets on the planet point their cameras at you.
In July 1967, Time magazine runs a massive cover story called The Hippies, Philosophy of a Subculture.
And a month later, CBS News airs a primetime television report titled The Hippie Temptation.
Okay, so what does this all mean? I have to wonder about the effect of that exposure, because today you see this happen on the internet all the time.
Oh, constantly.
A small community builds something meaningful with its own values. And the second a major platform or news network shines a light on it, it instantly becomes a watered-down, commodified trend.
People just copy the clothes without understanding the core message.
Exactly. Did Time magazine and CBS News effectively hijack and kill the original intent of flower power?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is the ultimate double-edged sword of social movements.
Okay, how so?
Yes, that sudden massive exposure absolutely softened the sharp political edge of Ginsburg's original tactical maneuver.
So it did dilute it.
It did. For many new arrivals, it became less about confronting the Hell's Angels or stopping a war, and much more about the fashion and the drugs.
Right.
However, we cannot underestimate the sheer power of that broadcast.
You mean the reach it had into everyday homes?
Exactly. That mainstream media coverage is exactly what allowed the underlying philosophies of the counterculture to permeate middle America.
Things like questioning authority, seeking peaceful resolutions, and exploring alternative lifestyles.
Yes. It introduced those radical concepts to millions of people who would never, ever have attended a protest at Berkeley or marched on the Pentagon.
The media packaged the philosophy inside the fashion and the music and basically smuggled it into the mainstream.
That makes perfect sense. They had to dilute it slightly so the wider public could actually swallow it.
Which transitions us perfectly to the final stage of this life cycle. Because to truly capture the mainstream, the movement needed a visual language.
And that massive exposure didn't just sell Grateful Dead records. It fundamentally rewired American art and design.
It completely took over. And the source credits this aesthetic shift to the avant-garde art of a few key figures: Milton Glaser, Heinz Edelman, and Peter Max.
Right.
And avant-garde basically meaning art that is experimental, radical, or pushing the boundaries of what is traditionally accepted.
Let's look at Milton Glaser first.
He founded Pushpin Studios and essentially developed that loose, swirling, psychedelic graphic design we all instantly recognize today.
The source highlights his incredibly famous 1966 poster of Bob Dylan.
Oh, that poster is iconic. It's Dylan's profile in a stark black silhouette, but his hair is this vibrant, explosive tangle of colorful paisley patterns.
Then you have Heinz Edelman. His illustration style was heavily utilized in the art designs for the Beatles' 1968 animated film Yellow Submarine.
He took that mind-bending, surreal visual style and put it into a feature-length film for the most popular band on the planet.
But if we're talking about the undisputed king of the flower power visual legacy, we have to talk about Peter Max.
Yes, the pop artist who truly codified the visual icons of the era.
He used these incredibly vivid, fluid designs painted in blazing day-glow colors.
And it's important to ask why those specific visuals resonated so deeply.
Goes back to contrast. Think about the aesthetic of the military and the establishment they were protesting against.
The military is defined by drab olive greens, straight lines, rigid borders, and conformity.
And Peter Max's art is the exact opposite.
It is neon, it is melting, the borders are fluid, and it is endlessly expressive.
The art itself is a rebellion against rigidity.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The craziest part is how successful that visual rebellion was.
Peter Max didn't just stay in underground galleries.
No, he brought this style to the absolute mainstream. He landed a cover story in Life magazine in September 1969.
And then he starts appearing on primetime television.
The source notes he was a guest on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson and The Ed Sullivan Show.
Which is an incredible trajectory when you stop to think about it.
It's the ultimate irony. Think about the sheer distance this concept traveled.
From the streets to the studios.
We started this journey in Berkeley with Allen Ginsberg literally trying to stop a motorcycle gang from beating up anti-war protesters.
That is as gritty and anti-establishment as the situation can possibly be.
And within just a few years, the visual aesthetic born out of that terrifying moment of survival is being celebrated by Ed Sullivan on primetime network television.
Ed Sullivan was the most mainstream, establishment, family-friendly platform in American history.
It reveals a profound truth about how culture digests rebellion. Aesthetics almost always outlive the specific political movements that birth them.
The anti-war protests were deeply tied to a specific geopolitical conflict.
Right.
But the visual language, the vibrant colors, the fluid lines, the literal imagery of the flower was adaptable.
It was visually pleasing.
Exactly. It could be stripped of the danger of a street protest and safely consumed by the public as art and fashion.
But, you know, knowing those gritty roots changes everything.
It really does.
It means that every time you see a Peter Max poster or a vintage tie-dye shirt or even a peace sign painted on a van, you aren't just looking at a fashion choice.
You are looking at the echoes of a survival tactic.
You are seeing the remnants of cognitive dissonance turned into art.
That is such a powerful way to frame it.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive today. We really hope tracing this journey has shown you why digging past the surface of these cultural movements is so vital.
It really is a masterclass in the life cycle of an idea.
We watched a concept begin as a tactical defense mechanism against the Hell's Angels.
We saw it morph into Abbie Hoffman's highly visible optical warfare against the military.
We heard it inspire the boundary-breaking soundtrack of Haight-Ashbury.
And finally, we watched it become the bright day-glow aesthetic that conquered mainstream television.
It serves as a powerful reminder that symbols are not just decorations. When used correctly, they are active, potent agents capable of shaping society and managing extreme conflict.
Absolutely.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to carry with you.
Yeah.
We've just spent this time exploring how a simple, fragile, physical flower could serve as such an incredibly unifying and disarming symbol. It forced an entire nation to look at its own violence.
So look around at our world today.
What is the equivalent symbol for today's fragmented, highly digital protest movements?
In our current era of fleeting hashtags, viral videos, and decentralized activism.
Is there anything out there right now that holds the sheer, undeniable visual power of a daisy resting in the barrel of a rifle?
Think about that.
Because as we've learned today, the next time someone tries to sell you a nostalgic fashion statement, you might actually be looking at a masterclass in survival.